C.K. Ute and Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
Cinema Politica for our fall screening series. Monday, November 21st. Primera, a film on the Chilean uprising. Monday, November 28th. The Clabona Keepers, looking at indigenous land and water defenders on the west coast of Turtle Island. Monday, December 5th, Into the Weeds, a celebrated documentary that looks at the struggle against multinational pesticide company Monsanto. These films show on Mondays at 7 p.m. in room H110 at Concordia University, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, Metro Guy Concordia. Info, cinemapolitica.org. These screenings are a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
You're listening to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's Wednesday, November 16th, just after 6 p.m. on this snowy day. And I'm your host for this month's In the Motherhood, Robin Fadden. On today's show, we are airing two interviews borrowed from community radio show Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. The first interview features Natasha Mango, a journalist and editor for the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Livestock in Zambia, and she's talking about her work that helps support women in agriculture in the era of climate change. Next up, we hear from longtime NDP politician Libby Davies, who represented Vancouver's downtown east side in city politics and the Canadian Parliament. And for a long time, back in another life, I lived in Vancouver in her riding, and I remember meeting her and talking with her. So now, it's been many years, she's talking about her new book called Outside In, a Political Memoir. So we'll play that in the second half of the show. So let's get to that first interview now. Thanks for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and thanks again to Wings for letting us air these interviews.
Today on Wings, Natasha Mahango from Zambia describes her journalism career based on covering what her audience most needs to know and sharing what they teach her.
If we don't take care of our resources, if we don't confront and accept that climate change is here and we have to do something about it, our food systems are going to break.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
My name is Natasha Mohango, and I am an agricultural journalist from Lusaka, Zambia. I have had about 13 years plus experience in the media industry, and actually maybe I could say 16 years, because I started out as an amateur journalist at the age of 15 when my friend's sister started a newspaper. It was called Trendsetters, and the objective of this newspaper was basically to give a voice to the youth, to talk about hard-hitting issues like their sexual reproductive health. In African culture, we can all, you know, think of a time back in the day when it was so hard for our parents to have honest and open conversations with us about our sexual reproductive health. So this newspaper kind of filled in the gaps. At the time I was 15, I was in 10th grade, and you know, it was something that I was doing for fun. Years later, I got my degree in mass communication. By then, Trendsetters had expanded into a very popular magazine. And so I joined them as a section editor and had some experience with writing and editing, particularly again in issues of sexual reproductive health of young people. So, you know, the media industry tends to be a little bit rough, especially starting out. Not many media houses want to take a chance on you, especially when it comes to like exciting desks and so on. So I decided to look for formal employment and found myself being employed by the Ministry of Agriculture. Now, our Ministry of Agriculture in Zambia has a media wing, which is called the National Agricultural Information Services. So I was taken to that wing where I have been employed as a writer and editor for the publication section. And the ministry has a quarterly magazine called Agriculture Today, which I usually edit and oversee the compilation of this magazine. I must admit that entering the ministry at that time, I didn't have any knowledge of agriculture. And I think maybe at the time, I must admit also that, you know, I wasn't that much interested. My interest grew because of issues of climate change. Looking at my work experience, I think I naturally have an interest in humanitarian issues, humanitarian stories. And so when I saw how climate change was affecting rural communities, that is where my interest in agriculture came in. It's a fact in Africa, you know, all rural communities depend on agriculture for their rural livelihoods. And so when issues of climate change came in, we were now seeing sad stories of how household nutrition was being affected, how household incomes were being affected. And naturally, when I was looking at how climate change was affecting agriculture, I would have to now go back and say, okay, so how do you grow this crop? And what happens if it doesn't have enough water or enough rain season? And so on. Also, I've had a growing interest in livestock farming, but effects of climate change are becoming more and more visible every year. Zambia in particular, I think we've seen that our agriculture growing season has started to diminish because the rain season has started to reduce. And we find even in this few months of rain, the rain is not consistent. Today we're talking about heavy floods in one part of the country while the other side is completely dry. I think farmers are slowly becoming alive to that fact. And as a result, they are becoming more hungry for information on how to make their lives better. So I think such stories and such incidents have really made my career a little bit more exciting because I'm spending more time talking to the rural farmer, hearing more personal stories of how climate change is affecting agriculture. On the other side, also, I think what keeps me interested in agriculture is those who are thriving to see, you know, they kind of show you that farming is indeed a business. And if you take it seriously, there is a lot of money to be made. We're looking at the direction the world is going through now. You're looking at global food crisis and so on. Naturally, the prices of food are going up. This is making agriculture also quite lucrative now, especially for young people as well. I have seen young people slowly thriving through agriculture. And I want to share with the youth how to make very good money if you're consistent with it, if you have a passion for it. So those are angles which are keeping me interested in agriculture reporting. Looking at my experience, agriculture can be quite technical. And like most science reporting, I think a lot of journalists approach with caution, because journalists were always accused of taking things out of context. And I think that's because we don't ask questions. I would talk from experience. You know, sometimes I was scared in the first years of my career to ask questions because I felt, you know, I just felt dumb. Like, oh my goodness, I'm asking such a basic question. Everybody in the room knows the answer to this question. So we don't clarify, you know, breaking down technical information for the audience. But with experience, I've seen that most of my audience are farmers. So there's no need to always break down information into nitty-gritty. There are certain concepts which they're able to get. And in the long run, my audience has helped me also to specialize into agriculture reporting. I'm learning from them and then I'm sharing information, and the people I'm sharing information with are also learning from us. And I think for me, there's a kind of I'd say satisfaction, which comes from that. I think every journalist can testify that it's a gratifying experience to know that you made some work, you did a production, you wrote an article, and people did read it and appreciate it, even if the comments come back and they're negative or they criticize the angle you've chosen. It's just nice to know that someone actually read your work.
On Wings, you're listening to Zambian agricultural journalist Natasha Mahango.
In the past 10 years, we've had government after government making very aggressive efforts to make agriculture the lead, the driver of the economy. And so I've tried to tailor my work, my agriculture reporting, to get that message out to farmers and also to give farmers a voice so that in this, you know, problem solving of climate change and the impact that it has on agriculture, at least I can provide a platform for, you know, farmers and other stakeholders to discuss and problem solve. I think also another thing that comes into play is the fact that the food industry will never die. As a country, Zambia has been depending so much on minerals. Of course, that still is the lead driver of the economy, but facts show that minerals are diminishing assets. But when you look at the food industry will never die. And I think there's a need now for more aggressive reporting on how we can conserve our soils, on how we can properly utilize the resources that we have. You look at Zambia, like most African countries, is fast urbanizing. Everything is becoming urban. Urbanization comes with a deforestation. And I think for me, what keeps me going in my career also is the need to get that message out, to say, you know, land cannot be reproduced, okay? It's not going to expand. If anything, it's diminishing with issues of climate change, rising water levels, and so on. So I think for me, my mission now is just to remind people that if we don't take care of our resources, if we don't confront and accept that climate change is here and we have to do something about it, our food systems are going to break. So I look at the agriculture sector, and another thing that I notice is that agriculture reporting, like most science reporting, is popularized more by male reporters. When you look at also the kind of people that we interview, the voices of the women farmers aren't so prominent. But I try to get the voices of the female farmers out. When you look at the balance that we're trying to bring, food security and nutrition, you find in rural communities, the nutrition part is always falling on the women. And so women in most traditional cultures tend to lead, you know. Women are always considered the chief nutritionists in the home. Even in urban cultures, I think women, even the working woman, is always expected to be the leader in the kitchen. And so if we want to tackle issues of nutrition, the female farmer is the first starting point. If she knows good nutritional practices, if she knows proper crop agricultural practices, she is the person that is going to improve the nutrition of her household. And so when I look at also the kind of agricultural reporting, we find ourselves now bringing in issues of gender balances. Gender is something else that I'm also passionate about, and there's so much gender inequality in agriculture. And if that gender inequality is not solved, issues of climate change will continue to impact rural incomes. Women still don't have easy access to land. Women don't have access to agricultural inputs. They don't have so much access, especially to credit. And so those are the issues that I like to bring out in my reporting. When I look at our field as communication specialists, I've also noticed that very few female reporters are in the industry. And I think it's because, I wouldn't say it's gender imbalances which are inflicted in the workplace, but I think it's also self-bias. I think women need to be encouraged to enter the field of science, the way we're encouraging young girls to go and study medicine, to go and study, you know, pharmacy and the like. That is what we also need to do when it comes to agriculture reporting, encourage more women to take on science assignments. And I think with more women on the science desk, we're also going to have more women voices on issues of agriculture and climate change. The last 2 years of my career, I have noticed the visible impact of climate change. About 10 years ago, when I was writing about climate change, it was very superficial. I was writing, this could happen, this might happen. And now I'm looking at those things having happened. We're in a situation where there are personal stories of how people have lost complete livestock to flooding. And so those are the stories that I enjoy so much the most. Not that I enjoy writing them, but I enjoy telling them in the hope that, you know, it reaches the ears of the right policymakers. I think we're in a situation where agriculture, the effects of climate change require policy action first before people on the ground can take action. When we discuss these issues with farmers, most of the time they are so interested in mitigation effects. They know what is happening. They know that the climate is changing, but they need more follow-up action on what they can do. They need recommended practices on how they can handle the issue. But what is most needed is early warning systems, and things like that need policy action. They need policy change which supports early warning systems.
On Wings, you're listening to Natasha Mahango, a journalist with Zambia's Ministry of Agriculture.
So when I'm talking to these farmers and I'm hearing these stories, and I think to myself, today I'm talking to a farmer in Lundazi district in Eastern Province. At the back of my mind, I know there's a farmer somewhere in Southern Province who's suffering the same fate. There's a farmer in Western Province who's suffering the same fate. And so I try to tailor and disseminate my stories into shareable pieces, things which farmers can share via WhatsApp, for example. When I look at the organization that I'm currently working for and that it is looking at educating farmers on climate change and mitigation effects, I try to tailor my stories in such a way that farmers can see that, okay, this is a global issue. This is happening everywhere. This is how Farmer A sorted it out. Maybe Farmer C can try it this way. And I've noticed at this point, print media still is one of the, not, I won't call it preferred choices, but it's the easiest ways for farmers to access and most importantly, share information. It's nice knowing that when I compile a magazine, for example, you give it to one farmer, he will keep it, he will share it, the neighbor can borrow it and read it, bring it back, this person can borrow it and read it. So that is why I have remained in the print side of things. I love to be able to package my content in such a way that there's a ripple effect. It will be shared from one person to the other. With growing social media now, I think WhatsApp is proving to be also a good platform for me to make very short mini videos within 2 minutes, make your point within those 2 minutes, make it shareable within WhatsApp. I think technology is now something which, you know, everybody is getting access to. We do have rural farmers who do have smartphones and they're able to see audiovisual messages on agriculture and climate change. And also, it's nice to disseminate information through agro events in Zambia. I'd say between March and August, we have seed fairs. There are a lot of events where farmers like to come and learn. And it's also a nice place for me to learn as well, because in my career, I've noticed that the rural farmer is also a specialist in their own right. So my word to, you know, policymakers also is when we're doing our policy making process, we should learn to consult the rural farmer. We should learn to respect indigenous knowledge, respect the fact that they are specialists in their own right. They have been farming from very young ages up to now. Most of us are learning from the book, which is a very different experience on the ground. And I like that. That's another thing which has kept me interested as an agriculture journalist. There's always something to learn. And my experience also has been a very colorful one, because I'm so targeted at the rural communities. I've found myself in a job where I'm always on the road, and I love to travel. I've seen how vast my country is. Zambia is a huge country, extremely vast, and I've been able to see firsthand the effects of climate change. I'm in one province and it's completely dry. Next week, I'm in another province and it's raining nonstop. It's been a very beautiful experience, if I can say that, at least having that firsthand experience of what farmers are going through. And it's my hope that within time, my audience could take what I say a little bit more seriously. I think we're in a situation where, not just me, but I think all environmental journalists and agriculture journalists can testify to the fact that when people see our content, they'll read it and they'll be like, oh, shame, that's sad, and they'll put it aside. But I think now we need to be a little bit more proactive. You know, we are watching global news, the effects of climate change, wildfires in Europe. I think in Africa, we have to be a bit more proactive. And I think journalists and environmental activists should come together and try and compel some more proactive action from our governments, especially when it comes to protecting our agriculture. And talking about agriculture and protecting our agriculture, I think something that I've learned along the way, which we slowly should start talking more about, is food sovereignty. I think that when we look at Zambia, I'll give an example of my own country, which has become a major maize producer in the region. When we look at how the maize industry is affected, or maize crop rather, is affected by climate change, I think it's also some kind of a warning to us to say, you know, it's time for us to reconsider going back to our indigenous seed and protecting our indigenous seed. I think traditional seed is proving to be more climate resilient. And so if we're going to promote food security in rural communities, we need to take more proactive, you know, action towards protecting indigenous seed. And through the reporting that I've done, especially on issues of, you know, food sovereignty, climate change, and so on, agriculture has exposed me to people that are interested in what I talk about. And when you meet people that are interested in what you're talking about, next thing it's, oh, let's have a meeting. Oh, we're having a conference this side. Why don't you come? And now I find myself expanding my horizons, my exposure to countries outside the continent, especially before COVID. I think I was in every continent except Australia, thanks to my job, you know, attending conferences on agriculture data and the importance of data and agriculture reporting and talking about climate change. And it's been a lovely experience. And I think those are the moments I look back, and I think coming into agriculture journalism was one of the best decisions I ever made. It was a by the way thing. At some point, I did want to leave because I was young and I thought, look, farming is for old people. But no, now my eyes have really opened up. And when I go into rural communities and I interact with little children sometimes, and I'll ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up? And when they say farmer, I'm like, you're the smart one. You are really the smart one. You know where the money is. But to wrap things up, I guess I can say that I'm very grateful for the experiences that I've had. Because agriculture is predominantly done by our countryside, rural communities, I think interacting with farmers has helped me remain grounded in my culture. There are certain communities that have really conserved their way of life. They have conserved the way they cook their food. They have conserved the type of food that they eat. And I think for me, it's a beautiful experience to be able to get in touch with my culture and the culture of other tribes in Zambia and the Zambian culture as a whole, just from how people grow and prepare their food. I think there's so much I don't want to say personality, but I would say tradition in the way that we produce our food. And I think it's a beautiful experience to see Zambian identity in food production. I never thought I would ever describe, you know, food production in that way. But I think there's a lot of cultural preservation which comes into rural food production. And the fact that our food is also mostly organic, I think it's a proud moment for me as an agriculture journalist to see how the Zambian identity comes out in food preservation, in food processing. So I think that's been one of the most beautiful things as an agriculture journalist, going into the rural areas and learning about a culture. So I think, to put it in a nutshell, I'd say it's not as scary as people think. I think science, yeah, there are technical terms which, you know, with time you learn how to break it down. And, you know, when you're speaking to farmers in vernacular, they also break down these terms for you. And like I said, it's a learning experience. So I think I've enjoyed every moment of my career in agriculture, and I don't see myself diverting into any other any other field. I think with time, of course, and focus on climate change, you kind of realize that, you know, agriculture and environmental reporting always interlap at such point, because agriculture is dependent on the environment. But I think generally these are issues that I've grown to love because I've learned so much about them. And, you know, it's just not one of those careers I would tell young girls to shy away. It's not boring at all. It's not technical. And I think if there's any female journalist out there, I would say, come and see what's happening in the farming industry. There are so many beautiful stories to tell, so many beautiful experiences. And I think also the other experience I have loved also about agriculture reporting is I now have a higher interest in what I eat and how it's produced. It's not that I'm a fussy person, but I think I look at the impact of some of the agricultural technologies that we're trying to promote. And then I come home and see how the rural farmer does it. And I have to admit that, in my opinion, I think our rural farmers have the right concept. They have the right way of doing things. If you look around the world today, everyone now wants to go back to organic food. Nobody wants processed food. I think Zambia is one of those countries that has a very small tolerance to genetically modified foods. And so that's one experience that I can say I love, knowing what I eat. And I love knowing that African food is generally very healthy. I think that's something that I've learned. And it's not just Zambian food. When I travel to other African countries, next door to Malawi, you look at production in Zimbabwe, you look at the traditional foods in East Africa, I think our food is really healthy. And I think if we can protect our indigenous foods, I think in the long run, we will ensure food security. I think we have to remember that, you know, farming is a business, and farmers will only grow what people will sell. And so I think if we want to really help the farmer promote indigenous foods, I think we have to also, you know, complement his work by diversifying our nutrition at home, diversifying the kind of foods we eat. I'm not saying, you know, everything westernized is bad and so on. But I think if we really want to grow our agriculture sector, I think as journalists, we need to tell more stories of how our food production systems, our local food production, indigenous food systems were functioning just fine and still offer us the best, you know, options in terms of food security, and also in terms of proper nutrition, and also in terms of, you know, health and the organic, you know, the way they're grown organically. So I think my final advice to journalists who want to enter agriculture reporting is that, you know, try to be the voice of the farmer. I'm so passionate about the rural farmer because I think the rural farmer is the one that feeds us all. Rural farmers are in the majority. Yes, I know they can't compete yet with, you know, commercial farmers, but you find that when we are looking for our indigenous foods, we rarely go into the supermarket. We always go to the lady on the street side who has bought the vegetables, who has dried them if we want them dried, who has preserved them and conserved them in the traditional way. So the agriculture journalists tell the story of rural production systems. I am a believer that the rural farmer has got the concept right. The rural farmer is the one who has the solution to climate change, and I think we need to share more and more of those stories. Thank you.
That was Natasha Mahango, a journalist with the Agriculture Department of Zambia. Diana Wanyonyi interviewed her for Wings. Zambia has long had very strict rules against importing genetically modified organisms that might pollute the agricultural gene pool. As of June 2022, a process intended to revise the rules and promote GMO use is meeting strong resistance.
You're listening to In the Motherhood on CKUT 90.3 FM. Next up, we ask, how much do national politics have to do with the everyday lives of parents and families? And some people would say a lot, others not so much, and some politicians address these issues much more than others. Up next, we hear from a lifelong politician who focused on the security of the most vulnerable people in our communities, including low-income women and families. Thanks to Wings for this interview with Libby Davies, who represented Vancouver's downtown east side in city politics and the Canadian Parliament. Here she talks about her new book, Outside In, a Political Memoir. Thanks for listening.
Today on Wings, from 1980 until 2015, Libby Davies represented the political interests of her neighbors on Vancouver's downtown east side, including homeless and underhoused people, sex trade workers, low-waged workers, and people with addictions.
You know, drug use exists at every level of society, judges, lawyers, professionals, cops, but it's the visibility of poverty that we see on the street that gets the target of law enforcement. That's changing. But for years, that stigma literally drilled people into their graves.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In July 2022, Libby Davies talked and read from her memoir, titled Outside In, about her 6 terms in city politics and 6 in Parliament with Canada's New Democratic Party. Issues she raised, like legalizing safe injection sites, decriminalizing sex work, raising minimum wage, and funding a national housing strategy, affected policies and continue to do so today.
Outside In. I've always felt like an outsider, and I think many people do. I've always felt that I was reaching in to this world of rules and process, and I've always been trying to figure out how that works. My mother, who lived to be 100 years old, told me that I was always a rebel, even as a kid, so much so that the relatives who didn't visit very often didn't like to meet me because I was kind of snarling and pushing. And so my mom always said, I broke every rule in the book. So it's always seemed strange to me to be so deeply immersed in the political world where there are so many rules, many of them unwritten, I can tell you, so many practices that are old and old-fashioned and don't make sense. I was elected over 31 years locally and nationally, and I think especially in Ottawa for 18 of those years, that it was like a deep dive into the murky depths of an ocean. And in that ocean, sometimes there were beautiful schools of fish that you could be a part of, and you could swim around and feel like you were part of something in this lovely school of fish. But I learned that in this murky underwater world, there were also monsters and predators who could hang out in caves, lurking, and could come out. And when you came up for air, when I came up for air, as I did every week, heading back from Ottawa to East Vancouver, I felt like I had to be careful because it was like coming up from a deep dive, you know, the benzies, you know, your brain was scrambled. Leaving that world, this crazy Ottawa bubble of politics and intrigue and all this insider stuff, back to my real world of East Vancouver, where people were literally dying on the street. And so part of my life, my political life and my personal life, has been trying to figure out how to reconcile those two different things. And sometimes I'd shake myself in surprise and wonder, and I still do, how did someone like me, really kind of a shit disturber from the downtown east side, never finished university, I don't have any degrees or anything, I just kind of got out there and started organizing. So how did someone like me end up in Ottawa as the house leader for the NDP and the only woman house leader? You know, every party has a political leader, of course, but we also have a house leader, and you're in charge of what goes on in parliament for your party. So it's very detailed. Who's speaking what? What do we do about this legislation? Are we for it, against it? How do we approach it? All of that inside parliament, where it was archaic, it was sexist, it was full of intrigue. And so these two different worlds were thousands of miles apart, not only geographically, but culturally, politically, and in any sense you cared to measure. So what motivated me is a sense of urgency about what we need to change when we can see injustice around us. And it feels personal because it's about people you know, it's about people you work with. I lived in the downtown east side I was age 20 after I left home. I was there for quite a few years. I was an organizer, and it was still called Skid Road in those days. And they were literally life and death issues, people dying in fires, people facing slum landlords and being evicted. I mean, these issues still go on today, unfortunately, almost 50 years later. But I needed to get in there and try and do something in my community, and transformative change and the need to figure out how to bring about transformative change is the reason I wrote this book. I left Ottawa in 2015, and my partner Kim, she really encouraged me to sit down and start just writing anything before I forgot, to communicate what I understand transformative change to be and how we can work for it together. Give ourselves voice, but also build allies and relationships and build a movement. And more importantly, how do we connect these worlds of politics that we feel often so cynical about and activism that's grassroots, that's full of energy and hope, but feels very cynical about the political world. And I encountered that 1,000 times over in many different ways, and I was always fascinated by it. And so I think it became sort of a mission for me to be some sort of bridge, because I came from that activist world. And even as a, quote, politician, I saw myself as an activist. And politics was just a tool, was just a way to look about how to bring about change. But I also wanted to write to overcome what I see increasingly from people is cynicism. You know, we live in this world where the corporate media shrinks and shrinks, the political discourse shrinks and shrinks. We look at what's happening to the south of us, and I think it's so easy to feel despair, to feel a lack of hope or optimism about what we're facing, whether it's environmentally, whether it's based on race, whether it's based on indigenous issues, the whole caboodle, right? It's all connected. And it's easy for us to feel powerless, like where do we begin? and to feel cynical that my voice doesn't count, your voice doesn't count, our voice doesn't count, because we've been told that over and over. How many articles have I read? How much in the media? You know, all politicians are bad, it's all corrupt, forget about those people, it won't make any difference. And I wanted to write about what difference there is, can be, and how we can overcome that cynicism, and that change is possible. It's very simple. Change is possible when we engage, with each other, when we engage with the systems, the forces, the obstacles around us, when we learn how to do it. So it, for me, it's always been, of course, it's about the what. You know, like if I asked every one of you in this room, what do you believe in? What do you dream about? What do you hope for? I know you could tell me in 30 seconds. But if I asked you also how do you do that? It's a much tougher question. So that's what I wanted to get into was the how. That change is possible. And it's the matter of turning frustration into action for change. And for many of the issues that I worked on, they were big issues that nobody wanted to deal with. When I went to Ottawa in 1997, people were dying every day of drug overdoses. Sex workers were disappearing. People were destitute and homeless on the street. And nobody in Ottawa wanted to talk about it. It wasn't considered, you know, the political agenda. And so I went to Ottawa thinking, my God, you know, like, where do I begin? So I was asking myself these questions. How do I take these issues that are so important and get that out there in Ottawa? And so I went there with that sense of urgency and motivation. And I want to begin with just a first reading that hopefully will give you a sense of what I faced at the very beginning. And this was actually the very first day that I arrived in Ottawa. It was the opening day. You know, you have that speech from the throne and all of that stuff. So, as luck would have it, an opportunity arose with the opening of the new parliament. The same day, I rushed through the anti-choice rally to get to parliament on time, as Julius Fisher filmed me. The speech from the throne is delivered in the Senate by the Governor General, and by custom, MPs traipse down the marble hallway and crowd into the Senate chamber entrance to hear the speech that outlines the government's agenda and intentions. I dutifully followed along with a crowd of MPs from the House of Commons, not feeling too enamored of the pomp and ceremony. It seemed a waste of time to me, and I felt slightly irritable and not at all in awe of the long-held tradition. Turning to look at the person next to me, I realized it was Alan Rock, the Minister of Health. Without thinking, I introduced myself. We were walking down the stately hall, squeezed together like a sedate mob, heading toward the Senate chamber. In a breathless rush, I stammered that I represented the riding of Vancouver East and that people were dying from drug overdoses and we needed to stop that. It was a life and death situation, I told him, looking him straight in the eye. I asked if I could meet him to explain more. He smiled and said, "Of course. Just contact his office." I have no other memory of the speech from the throne, only jubilation that the Minister of Health had agreed to meet me on this critical issue. I headed back to the riding in Vancouver, and a few days later, I held a press conference in my small community office on Main Street. The storefront office was already busy with constituents coming by to ask for help, and on that day, reporters showed up as Bud Osborne and I talked urgently about the drug crisis and the need for a health-based approach by the federal government. The province newspaper gave a lively headline the next day. "Give junkies drugs," says MP. Quote, doctors should be permitted to prescribe hard drugs, heroin and cocaine, to addicts, Libby Davies, NDP MP for Vancouver East, said yesterday. Quote, it's time for politicians to really stand up and deal with the issue fair and square, and some new approaches are needed, she said. The headline was a bit startling, but so far, so good, I thought. At least we're getting people's attention. Back in Ottawa, we had not yet had a response on my promised meeting from Alan Rock's office. And the realization sunk in that, of course, it wasn't so easy for a new opposition backbencher to secure a formal meeting with a government minister. So much for my naive jubilation. I stewed over this a bit and tried to think what Bruce would have done to get a meeting. And then I got it. I walked down to the minister's office after question period, and I carefully opened the door. I put on my best smile and explained to his office staff that we had tried repeatedly to follow up on the minister's agreement to meet with me on the dire situation in the downtown east side. They seemed completely unaware of this and said they would look into it and get back to me. I knew they wouldn't. I politely told them I wasn't going to leave their office until they booked a time to meet within a reasonable time period, say a couple of weeks. There was silence. Then I added that I had media waiting outside the door. This wasn't quite true. Though I had talked to Gary Engler at the Vancouver Sun, who was on standby to hear how things went. More silence. I stood there waiting, and then sat down with a determined look on my face. It was now clear I wasn't leaving until something happened. Within a few minutes, the staffer came back and said, yes, absolutely, a meeting could happen, and named the specific day and time. I said thank you and left. My hands were shaking, and I felt a rush of adrenaline and relief that I hadn't been kicked out. It felt pretty good that, aided by Bruce's example, my community organizing instincts had kicked in. I had my first meeting with the minister in November. I don't remember much from the meeting, only that I implored him to allow a safe injection site to be set up and to allow doctors to legally prescribe heroin to chronic users, and that housing was a huge priority too. I want to skip now to another issue that was motivating me and that was huge and that brought me into this question again of how to bring about change, how to take an issue that nobody wanted to deal with and bring it into the mainstream. And I think I figured out much later on that my role in politics was to do that. It was to take things that were seen as marginal or, you know, just kind of not on the radar, and to push and to make them not necessarily win or achievable, but to make it more mainstream. And I realized that's what my role was. So again, I'm just quoting from my book. I knew a few of the missing women personally and many by name. I met Serena Abbotsway when, as a member of VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, she was becoming politically active. I would often run into her on the street in the downtown east side, and we would chat about what was happening at VANDU. She had warm brown eyes and a slightly crooked smile that lit up her face. I couldn't help but notice the scars on her face and skin, a visible reminder of her hard life. She was very interested to learn how things worked in Ottawa, and she told me she wanted to get involved politically in the upcoming election. I want people to vote, she said. When Kim and I walked her to the Chinese Cultural Center on election day in 2000, she was excited because it was the first time she'd ever voted. True to what she had said, Serena was getting her friends to vote too, and I could see the pride in her face that she was taking charge, explaining the voting procedure and what to do if you weren't on the voters list, which most people weren't. I saw her a few times after that, and then, like so many others, Serena disappeared. She was later to be identified as one of Picton's victims. The trauma and suffering in the community were shattering. You could feel it on the street, the gnawing sense of community loss. Often I would go to Maine and Hastings and hang out just outside the Carnegie Center or a little further down the block where Insight was located. The street was always full of people. Even when it was miserable, cold, and raining, they would still gather and talk. So many times people would say how worried they were because they hadn't seen a friend in a few days. The fear about more sex workers going missing was on everyone's mind. And so part of my challenge was how to take that issue, which I think was the toughest issue I've ever worked on, and bring that to Ottawa. So in writing this book, I wanted to write not only about transformative change in terms of issues like this or the drug issue, but also how we do need to engage with each other. And there are things that I learned about taking on some of these tough issues that I write about. And one of the things I learned is that it's, again, these are obvious things, but I think sometimes we don't think about them. We need to build trust, especially on the left. As I get older, I get more and more tired of the divisiveness and the, you know, the judgment. And I feel that we have to create space for people, especially young people, especially new people who are new to political activism. And we have to withhold our judgment and that the fact that we think we know everything and put aside the people who tend to dominate the political scene, whether it's in the community or whether it's in the formal world of politics. So in working on these issues, what motivated me and what kept me going was the connection I had to the community. That gave me the realism and the sense of imperative. And so I always saw Ottawa as just a place to do the business. You know, and a lot of people go into politics because they want power, and they get off on that, and they get a big charge out of it. It was never like that for me. It was more about issues and fighting for change and building alliances with people in the community. I also learned that if I wanted to bring about change on some of these issues, I had to understand my adversaries, even within my own party. Even within the NDP caucus, I would get a reaction and saying, "Libby, you're crazy. We're not gonna support setting up safe injection sites." I remember one MP from New Brunswick. He says, "Libby, if I go and talk about this or it gets out in my community, they're gonna think it's crazy, you know?" Because back then it was a criminal model. People who used drugs were criminals. And the response was lock them up. It was enforcement. Every day I used to get hundreds of emails from constituents saying, "Get rid of these people. Why are you enabling them? Why are you speaking for them?" And I decided, in fact, my own campaign manager said, "You know, Libby, you got to be careful. You may not get reelected." And I thought, well, God damn it, if I don't get reelected, I don't care. We've got to speak out on this issue, and we've got to speak the truth about what's going on. But getting in the head of your adversaries, that was something that was very important. I mean, I worked within a liberal government, within a conservative government through the Harper years, minority governments. And it was always the connection in the community with people at VANDU or Pivot or other organizations that propelled me to do the job that I needed to do in Ottawa. And I would go back to East Vancouver every week, and I would literally just hang out at Maine and Hastings, like stand on the street, and people would just come by and you'd hear what was going on, and I would see the resilience that people had, that people were fighting back. And it always amazed me that the people who had the least amount of resources, the least amount of power, were the people who were prepared to fight the hardest. And I thought, well, you know, if people can do that, then I certainly can do my part in Ottawa. Now, in writing this book, there was an interesting byproduct. And it was only when I started writing it and, you know, thinking about a timeline of what happened when and various experiences. And I went back to my early organizing days in the Downtown East Side and then running for city council in the 70s and then getting elected. And so what came out of those reflections was that I had been a woman in politics. And what did that mean? Because I'd never thought about it. So weird. I was always so busy. I never thought about it. And all of my mentors were men. You know, there were very few women in politics when I got elected in 1980 at the Park Board and then 82 at City Hall. And it was only in writing this book that I kind of went, God damn it, it was pretty awful. And we found this clip from the Jack Webster show. Who remembers old Jack Webster? He would have candidates on his show. My partner was also on city council, Bruce Erickson. We worked together very closely. Bruce was already on council. I was running. We had a three-year-old son, Leif Erickson, name you don't forget. And so looking at this clip today, I am horrified. There's Jack Webster. Well, Libby, I see that your husband's trying to get you elected. Well, first of all, we weren't married, but... And then he goes on, and who's going to look after baby Leif? If you're doing, who's going to look after little Leif? And there I am. I look so innocent and polite. Now I just like, you know, fuck you. But back then I was like, Mr. Webster, don't you worry about Leif. We'll take care of him. And so it made me think more and more about sexism in politics and what I and is still faced today. And so I started writing about that in the book. And I'll tell you, I think I've got more to say on this because I'm still processing it because I think this happens, you know. And the bottom line is this. We want a parliament. We want a political process and system that is diverse, that represents who we are as people in all of our diversity. And yet it is dominated by these, you know, archaic institutions and rules and usually men who are very dominant and set in the way they do things. And we have to shake that up. So part of this book is about how to shake up that political world, how to, inside the party, in the caucus, in the parliament, but also in the community, and how do we bring these things together. I see Dr. Goldman here, and he was speaking about yesterday about teamwork, and where are those voices? You know, I went up to him yesterday and said, the two nurses that you spoke about, they were probably women, and as you said, they didn't get heard. So when we talk about kindness or teamwork, you know, I think women do this much better by and large than men. So how do we transform these kinds of institutions? So these are all things that I kind of get in and out of in this book. But mostly it's about transformative change and how we can bring it about and how we can make it real. And oh, just for a little plug on the workshop. So the workshop tomorrow, it's not a dialogue with me. Well, it is, but I mean, it's a workshop on lobbying. Okay? It really pisses me off that there are these huge corporate lobbyists who get paid huge bucks. They have all kinds of power and influence in Ottawa and everywhere else. You never see them. It's all behind closed doors. What do we do? Don't we have voice? Don't we have power? Can we not lobby? Of course we can. You know where the term comes from? In most parliaments, there's lobbies, right, where the governing party hangs out, where the opposition hangs out. And so literally, when you lobbied, you were walking down the hallway and buttonholing someone and saying, hey, I want this contract, right? Now, there are rules about lobbying. You have to register. There is a public registry. Yes. Yes, and that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. How can you lobby? Now, to do it totally on your own would be pretty hard. But if you're part of a group, or some sort of alliance or something. Lobbying is entirely achievable. So I'm very sorry I left you with the idea that it's all, you know, doom and gloom, because I just feel so hopeful about what change can be and how it can happen. And one of them is through lobbying. You know, lobbying is just part of a picture of, you know, like getting out at big rallies on the streets is very important, too. It's not either or. It's all these things. But lobbying is a part of it.
Former member of the Canadian Parliament, Libby Davies, speaking and reading at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in July 2022. Her memoir is called Outside In. Davies also gave a workshop on becoming a registered lobbyist. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Thanks again to Wings, Women's International News Gathering Service, for letting us air these interviews on CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. You can contact me, Robin Fadden, at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca or on Facebook at ckut-inthemotherhood. If you have any ideas for future shows, would like to get in touch, simply have something to say. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades all, to Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're back again with news and analysis and briefings from the continent of Africa. And Gwen, we've quite a lineup tonight. It's looking really smart.
Yes, a lot of very nice original radio material tonight for our listeners. So we're going to kick off with an interview that I did with Catherine Cummins, who is with Mining Watch Canada. And we're back to a same old story, which is the activities of Canadian gold mining company Barrick Gold in North Mara in Tanzania. This is a long, old, and very difficult story. Barrick regularly recycles and rebrands itself and tries to leave a very checkered environmental and human rights story behind it. But Catherine is just back from a fact-finding mission in Tanzania, and what she found, sadly, is more of the same with Barrick. And it's very, very difficult relationship with local communities.